Welcome to Silicon Economics. Silicon Economics is a podcast where we explore the intersection of technology and economics. I'm Rob Soderbery, Executive Vice President and General Manager of the Flash Business here at Western Digital. With me is my co-host,
Adarsh Kannan, VP of Economics and Data Science here at Western Digital.
Adarsh and I are excited to bring you this episode. Let's jump in. Hi, everyone. Today we are really putting the economics in the Silicon Economics podcast. I am so pleased to welcome Michael Ostrovsky. Michael, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, Michael has done seminal work in multiple areas of econ. As everybody out there knows, we've been on an economic journey here at Western Digital, and that's been led by Adarsh. Adarsh, why don't you bring us up to speed on who Michael is and his background?
Yeah, thank you, Rob. It's really a privilege to sit across Michael, and I can probably say now that I'm one of the very few people who's met the Ostrovsky, Schwartz, Edelman, the trio of the generalist.
All three of them.
All three of them, and I happen to have the privilege of working with two of the three and sitting across the third today, and that's a seminal work on generalized second price auction, which powers billions of dollars of transactions in online marketplaces, including large search engines, retailers, and whatnot. Great to have Michael here. And of course, Michael is also a co-founder and chief scientist of TopSort. The name actually has something interesting to do with the auctions, but I'll wait for Michael to open up more on TopSort and give us a little bit of a template on that.
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe start with what you're working on these days and what you find interesting.
Yeah, sure. So, what I find fascinating and how I ended up in economics is I love using kind of game theoretic tools and mathematical tools to analyze real world markets and figure out ways to make them work better. And so obviously one of the areas that I'm still working on, as Adarsh mentioned, is auctions for online advertising. That's, when we wrote our first papers on this topic, we had, we hoped it would be important, but we had no idea that it was going to explode the way it did. So I'm still working on that, both in terms of my research and in terms of applying it to practice via TopSort. And then another area that I'm getting very interested in and have written a couple of papers and now almost ready to release another one is thinking about congestion pricing and other ways of regulating transportation markets, because as self-driving cars come into the picture and are getting more and more real, I think it's going to become even more important to regulate these markets properly. And, how can we take advantage of this technology in such a way that we don't just get even more congested cities? So that's kind of the second big area of research that I'm working on right now.
Michael, tell us a little bit more about generalized second price auctions.
Yeah, sure. So that's actually goes back, at this point, 20 years. When I was a PhD student at Harvard, and Ben Edelman was also a PhD student, and Michael Schwartz was junior faculty there, and Ben and I were chatting actually over beers during happy hour for PhD students in the Harvard Econ department, and we both independently noticed that there are these really interesting, quirky auctions where people sell and buy and sell words, like literally English words, and they were just taking off, and we said, let's look at them because, as a PhD student, you'll look for something new and exciting to work on. And already at that point, I was interested in auctions. I was familiar with, pioneering work by Paul Milgram and Bob Wilson on auctions for electromagnetic spectrum. But I was not that interested in working on that because I figured, they've already done that. I want to work on something new. So Ben and I decided to look at these auctions. And as we started getting deeper, we realized two things. First of all, they were bigger than we initially thought, and they were growing. And there was some keywords that cost tens or up to even $100. I think there was a famous case of a keyword mesothelioma, which was bid on by lawyers who were looking for people to file asbestos lawsuit for. And mesothelioma was that very special keyword that you would not randomly type in. So that keyword was going for something like $50 or $100. And we're like, okay, this is interesting that people are willing to pay that much. But the other thing that we realized was that these auctions were unlike anything else we've seen before. They clearly had some similarity. But what made these auctions special were several things. One was that advertisers would submit just one bid. They would say, you know, here's how much I'm willing to pay per click. But in return, you know, they could win multiple different positions, right? So usually when you can build multiple objects, you submit multiple bids. But there, there was kind of a unified auction where you will submit a bid, but the position, you didn't know in advance what it would be. And in fact, you know, every time someone was searched for this keyword, you may end up with a different position. So that was one that was already quite interesting. And of course, higher positions are more valuable than lower positions. So at least in terms of the volume of clicks that you get. And another thing that was very interesting is that these auctions take place over time. So it's not, you know, when you buy, you know, when you bid for a painting on Sotheby's or Christie's, you know, there's just one painting and then you run the auction once, and then once the painting is sold, the auction is over. Here, you submit your bid, and then it remains active kind of in perpetuity until you cancel your campaign. That creates a whole new dynamic dimension where if you have a limited budget, for example, for advertising, then you start thinking, how do I spread my budget over time? How do I interact with my competitors? Maybe I lose to right now, but then 15 seconds later there is another auction for the same keyword, and maybe I will win that one. So we realized A, it's important and growing. B, it's complicated and interesting, and it's clearly very novel. So we started looking at them more closely, and we tried to actually get some data. We figured that, you know, before theorizing about those auctions, we're like, let's actually see what they look like. Fortunately for us, there was, you know, he's still around, and you know, we owe him a big debt. David Pennock, who was a computer scientist originally at Overture, which was the company that Yahoo bought, that pioneered these auctions. And you know, Ben knew him from his earlier work, and you know, David and at that point I think Yahoo, they shared some data with us, and our very first paper with Ben documented some really interesting dynamic patterns in the first iteration of these auctions, which were actually generalized first price auctions, where bidders would bid their own bid, where they would pay their own bid every time someone clicked. It was clear from our papers, and I think by then it was becoming clear to the industry that this is not the right format to use, at least at the time.
You may want to explain to our viewers and listeners, like, yes, you know, like, why, what's a first price auction? Because the moment a lot of them listen to auction, they're thinking of the Sotheby's, you know, second of auction, yep, where there is, or like a cattle auction, right, where there's like this limerick going on, yep, and they're kind of bidding. All of those are intern auctions, but there's actually a difference between that and this kind of auction. So you may want to tease that out.
Absolutely, yes. So let me give like a brief kind of primer. First, I'll talk about the first price auction, and then I'll talk about the second price. So in the very first format for these keyword auctions that Overture pioneered, the way these auctions work, suppose I'm a seller of, you know, blue shirts, and I want to advertise those blue shorts to users of a search engine that search for blue shorts. And I go and submit a bid on keyword blue shorts and say, every time someone clicks on the on my ad, I can, you know, I'm willing to pay up to $7, right? $7 per click. And then, of course, there are multiple sellers of blue shorts, and each one of us is going to submit the bid. And then every time there is actually a user who is searching for blue shorts, the search engine will, you know, they will display the organic results. Those are unaffected by the auction. It's kind of the integrity of the organic part of the business. But then they would go to their database and they would look at all the current bids for the keyword blue shirt. And then initially, in the very first implementation, they would simply rank the results by the bid. Whoever bid the most would be shown in the first position. Whoever bid the second most would be shown in the second position, and so on. And they would display those results in that order.
And those are valuable in that order, right? Like, because, yeah, you know, naturally when we kind of go to search, we like to click the top one.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, you know, like empirically, if you look at the data, kind of the drop-off factor position by position is about 60 to 70%. So if the top click get the top slot expects to get about 100 clicks, the second one will get somewhere between 60 and 70. The third one will get less than 50. So that's kind of the order of magnitude of. So indeed, the top positions are the most valuable. And so that obviously creates the incentive for the advertiser to bid as much as possible. Now, the issue was the generalized, and under the generalized first price auction, if someone actually clicks on your ad, then you would pay your own bid. So if you bid $7, you would pay $7, which sounds very natural. And in fact, it worked like that for a few years. The issue was that auction design is the following. It's precisely due to the dynamic structure of the auction. So imagine there are just, you know, two of us. Suppose, you know, obviously there are more advertisers, but for simplicity, suppose it's just you and I bidding on keyword blue shorts. So if I show up, of course, I'm going to bid the lowest possible amount, you know, just 1 cent, because why would I want to bid more if I'm the only advertiser? Then you will show up and you will bid 2 cents because you want to outbid me. So I will bid 3 cents and we'll keep, you know, outbidding each other, which sounds perfectly fine, right? It sounds like just like what's happening in the paintings auctions or other auctions that that you're familiar with. And so far, so good. Now, at some point, we get to a level where one of us, let's say me, says, you know what, I don't want to bid that high for the top position. And here's where something interesting happens, because unlike the auctions for paintings, it's not like they drop out and disappear. The bidder can say, you know what, I'll just settle for the second position. Right? Second position, you know, it gets 30 to 40% fewer clicks, but I can get it much cheaper. So then they say, you know what, if I'm willing to settle for the second position, I might as well bid as little as possible for that position. So they go back to bidding 1 cent.
Right.
At which point the first bidder says, oh, if my competitor is bidding 1 cent, I can only bid two. I can bid two. And the whole cycle restarts.
So it's like people who win feel bad in one sense because they think they might have overpaid and they want to start correcting down.
Yeah.
And the people who lose do the other way, right?
So in fact, in the very first implementation, because Overture wanted to make the markets very transparent, you could even see what your competitors are bidding. So you could just see, you know, if you could see what they're bidding, and then you say, oh, I'm just going to bid the lowest possible amount.
And were there precursors to this phenomena, or was this like the first time this was sort of captured with a full data-rich, examined auction process?
I think this particular pattern, I think it's really the first time. Because it's one of the first auctions where everything was so automated.
Right.
And so cleanly documented and so comparable,
right?
Because it's the same keyword over time.
It probably reached that end state relatively quickly.
So I don't know. Well, so the auction started in around 1998, and our data was from 2003 or 2004, around that time. So, yeah, but it's something that you learn pretty quickly. And also, I think the final kind of nail in the coffin of that system was that bidders could use auto-bidders. Right. Instead, it's not like they had to manually go and change the bids. They could say, log into the system, see what my competitors are doing, submit the bid that's optimal given what they're doing. And so what we ended up doing in that paper with Ben, we just documented this very clear sawtooth pattern where you see like the maximum bid going up, then it drops and it goes up again.
Right.
And it's
a dysfunctional
and it looked almost like a heartbeat. It's like regular patterns. Yeah. It was an interesting sort of an unusual paper. Like we didn't have to do any econometric analysis errors because it was just obvious from the pictures. And so, you know, that was an issue with that design. And when Google introduced their design, which is known as a generalized second price auction, they said, well, the reason for this problem is that you pay your own bid, right? And so once you're bidding, let's say, $2 more than your competitor, you're just wasting those $2, and then you have an incentive to be just 1 cent above your competitor, and then the whole, you know, that's the whole cycle restarts. And they said, you know, we're going to charge each bidder the bid of the next highest bidder, right? So this way, if my competitor is bidding $3 per click and I'm bidding $5 or $6 or $4, it doesn't matter, I'm gonna still pay $3.
You win, but
you still win. Yeah. So yes. So whether you win or not is determined by your bid. But given that you win, what you pay is the bid of the next highest bidder, and so that removes this very strong incentive to fine tune your bid just by every penny. But that's where our second paper starts, and this is where we started working with Michael Schwartz, trying to kind of understand these auctions better. And this one we kind of figured that we're going to spend even more time on, because the first one, you know, we documented this funny pattern, but those auctions were already being deprecated because of all these patterns. But this general second price auction was taking off. And so we really want to understand the properties of these auctions. So they fixed this particular issue, but is it optimal for the bidders to bid their true value, or is what's going to happen in this auction? And what we showed in the paper, kind of with Michael and Ben, is that in this new design in the generalized second price auction, it is still not optimal for the bidders to bid their true value, but we can actually characterize what the equilibrium is going to look like. Unlike the generalized first price auction, there is going to be a stable equilibrium where everyone is behaving optimally given what everyone else is doing. Not only could we get the solutions in sort of analytical closed form, so we can just write a formula for the optimal bids given what everyone else is doing, but it was also very easy to analyze, and we could also sort of invert these formulas to get an estimate of the values of the bidders if they're behaving according to this way. So I think that was a really kind of, we were very happy with the contribution, because we started with this like mess of an auction where you have all these things moving around, and we kind of managed to find something that was both very interesting theoretically, because it was kind of unexpected. You have this auction where on one hand, like it's not perfect in the sense that it doesn't give people the incentive to just bid truthfully, to bid their true value, but at the same time, it's relatively simple to analyze, gives very concise formula for optimal bids, and could easily be used in practice. So I think that was part of the reason.
And were you able to sort of quantify how far that was from a theoretically perfect result?
Yes. So that was a big part of our paper. So again, in the real world, you're never lucky enough to do something that's theoretically perfect, because there are all kind of complications and bells and whistles. But there is this mechanism that was initially proposed by William Vickrey, who won the Nobel Prize in part for this contribution, and then it was elaborated by Clark and Groves. It's known as the VCG, Vickrey-Clark-Groves mechanism, that is kind of this theoretically perfect auction where it is optimal for each bidder to bid truthfully. I mean, it has some other issues, but at least in this setting, it would give bidders kind of truthful incentives. But what we found in our paper, and it was kind of one of our main results, is that if we look at this Vickrey auction and kind of the outcome of this Vickrey auction, and then we'll look at this generalized second price auction and assume that bidders behave according to these equilibrium kind of formulas that we derive, the outcomes, the expected revenues, and the expected profits of the bidders are going to be the same as in this theoretically perfect mechanism. So in a sense, the imperfections in payment rules
wash out.
Exactly, that's exactly right. Yeah. So the design was not, is not the same as VCG, but then the bidding strategies are also, people, bidders are not bidding truthfully.
Right.
They're bidding something different, and these two exactly cancel out.
At least
in the stylized theoretical model. Right. Of course, then there is a question, in reality,
how
accurate
it
is. And part of what's been happening in the literature and both in practice is that, researchers have been kind of analyzing this
auction mechanism,
these differences. And just to kind of add a bit of color to this, there isn't a kind of natural question. So why didn't someone like Google switch to VCG? And a short answer, I don't know all the reasons, but I think a short answer is like, well, if you don't expect to see any revenue change, why bother?
Right.
And the company that did actually switch to something much closer to VCG was Facebook.
Mm. Right.
And the reason why they did this, it's exposed kind of clear, but it took them some time, because they also started with generalized second price auction. If you think about Facebook on the desktop, it's not clear that you have just a single ordered list, right? The generalized second price auction is It very much depends on the notion, the top slot, second slot, third.
Quantitative third, relationship between the value of these spots.
Yeah, whereas on Facebook, it's two-dimensional.
Right.
So there is a slot here, there is a slot here. Like
in something in the feed.
And exactly, something in the feed, something on the right. Sometimes you can scroll left and right for the ads. And so the general second price auction is just, it needs to know what the next highest bid is. Whereas the Vickery auction is the general principle where you can apply it even if everything is multidimensional. So for them, they went the VCG route, not so much for revenue reasons, but just for the reasons that, you know, they could either, I mean, I'm sure they could have adapted generalized second price auction to this multidimensional environment, but they figured, you know, we need to change it anyway, so might as well go to the
theoretically optimal mechanism.
Yeah.
Can you clarify that a little bit more? Why it's a very different bid dynamics when you go from first price to second price?
Sure, and in fact, that's something that kind of even predates our paper, because like the contribution of our work is really to these auctions with multiple positions. Mm-hmm. But this particular tension you're describing, it's present even in the auctions for a single item.
Correct. Yeah.
Right? So, you know, suppose we're selling this, suppose I'm selling this mug to the two of you, and, you know, I don't know how much you value this mug, but suppose, you know, you value it at $3 and you value it at $5. And suppose what I tell you is, secretly tell me how much you value this mug, like maybe write on a piece of paper, and I'm going to open those pieces of paper. And then whoever has the highest number, I'm going to sell the mug to that person at that number. Right. So then if your value for the mug is $3, you're not going to write down $3, because if you actually get it and pay $3, you're left with a profit of zero.
Right.
So now you're sitting there and thinking, okay, how much should I write down? Should I write down 1.5? Should I write down 2? So you go through this calculation, but for sure you're going to submit a number that's substantially less than your true value. Right, so this charging your own bid creates this downward pressure on the reported bids. Whereas if I tell you, write down the number, and if your bid is the highest, I'm going to charge the second highest bid. Then suddenly this incentive disappears, and in fact you can bid truthfully, because the only thing that your bid determines is whether you're going to win the object or not. You cannot affect the price.
Correct.
So that removes your incentive. So in fact, you will write down $3 and $5. Mm-hmm. And so again, it's a similar effect where so under one auction, you're going to charge the higher bid, but all the bids are going to be lower.
Right.
And in the other format.
You've exposed the underlying economic value, and you've ended up with the best result for all parties.
Yeah.
Now, how does reserve pricing play into this?
I'm actually curious to hear Mike's version of this. Yeah.
Sure. So reserve prices, it's a fascinating issue, because if you're an auctioneer and you're selling again, let's go back to the example I just mentioned. I'm selling a mug, and let's just to keep it simple, let's just assume I have no value for the mug. So if I don't sell it just disappears. You know, my value is zero. So you may think that then I should just sell whoever is bids the most wins the mug, and if you bid 1 cent and you bid 2 cents, so be it. And from the point of view of economic efficiency, that would actually be the efficient outcome, right? The efficient outcome is not to have a reserve price in that case. But from the point of view of revenue maximization, that turns out that's not the case. From the point of view of revenue maximization, you actually do want to set a certain level of reserve prices.
And this is because the economic efficiency basically goes to say that it's good for the society that
mug had no value.
Correct. Exactly.
Right,
to
the manufacturer of the mug.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's good for the society. It's wonderful for the bidders.
Right.
But for the seller, it turns out that it's not optimal. I mean, the easiest thing to example to give them: imagine that you produce some software. Your marginal cost of giving out more units is zero. So kind of from the societal point of view, it would be optimal for you to just give it away to everyone for free. But clearly companies don't do it because they don't make any money, right? So it's actually similar intuition. So with reserve prices, it's optimal to set it at some sort of moderate level. And there is actually a famous paper by Roger Myerson from the 1980s that he got his Nobel Prize for, on how to compute the optimal reserve price and how to show that this is actually the best you can do in auctions. Like, because in principle, you could think the optimal mechanism can involve a lot of moving parts. Maybe one person goes first, the other person goes second, and you know, you can imagine all kinds of bells and whistles in an auction. But you know, his paper shows that at least in the kind of baseline case, you cannot do better than just run a simple second price auction with an appropriately chosen reserve price. And when after we wrote our first paper, well, our second paper, the paper with Ben and Michael, I presented that paper at, I think it was the EC conference. I think it was like the first or second workshop on sponsor search auctions because they were just starting. And there were some people at Yahoo, from Yahoo, at this conference, and they got really interested. They're like, "Oh, this is really cool," because they were mostly engineers and they knew a lot about the retrieval and ranking and search and all these things, but they knew very little about auctions. But they had to implement them, and we started talking, and they're like, "Look, let's collaborate. Let's find some projects that are interesting intellectually to you guys that are useful for the company."
This is industry academia relationship happening.
Yeah. So this was, you know, this happened at, you know, at EC. And this, you know, there were actually multiple projects that, you know, we helped them with some of them, but the one that, at least for me, was the most exciting was this reserve prices, because they said, "Look, we're selling all these keywords on Yahoo, and we have the same reserve price of 10 cents for every single keyword. And we know that different keywords have dramatically different values, right? So you have mesothelioma, that's $50 to $100. You have, you know, car insurance, that's also a very valuable keyword. Each click is, you know, tens or 20, you know, 10, 20, $30. But then you have some other keywords, you know, some pop stars. So back then it was, you know, Michael Jackson. Now it would be, you know, Taylor Swift, where each click is not that valuable, but the number of clicks is massive. Right. So you still want to set a correct reserve price. It just has to be much lower than for car insurance.
This is high value versus high volume.
Exactly. And so they, but the reserve price is per click. So they should be very different. And, you know, we met with them. So Michael and I met with them. And we're like, you know what? There is this wonderful paper. And it was before he won the Nobel Prize that theoretically shows how to set those reserve prices. And they're like, "Oh, cool. Who has done it before? Like, you know, can we see?" And like, "No one." You know, it's a theoretical paper that no one has tried to put in practice. But we think, you know, this particular setting is the one. It's perfect. And one of the reasons why that particular setting was perfect, well, there are several reasons. One reason is that there are lots of different keywords. So we can actually run a controlled experiment, right? We can take, you know, thousands of keywords and then take a fraction of them and implement the new reserve prices and keep the other one as a holdout. And so we can do a proper comparison. And it's not just an A-B test because it takes time for markets to equilibrate. Right. So you need to hold it for a while. So that's one. The other reason is that in many real-world markets, the seller still has some value for the good they're selling, right? And there is some cost involved. And so you really need to start thinking dynamically. If I don't sell it today, I will sell it tomorrow. Whereas the theory was very much about kind of a one-shot thing. And if you think about the setting of online advertisements, right, what I'm selling is a slot on a web page, and if I don't show an ad there, it genuinely disappears. So right. The value for the seller of that slot is genuinely like zero. There is no sort of, they can put some sort of house ad, but by and large, there is really no issue that, "Oh, I will resell it tomorrow." Because like there's an opportunity right now, and it's not going to be there tomorrow. So
it's like a perishing inventory.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, to their credit, they're like, "Okay, that's, you know, it's, there's a lot of money at stake. It's an important project." So we spent a substantial amount of time working on this, analyzing all the real world issues, and eventually we ran the experiment. It made them huge amounts of money, and they put everything into production. And we wrote it up in a paper. And this is a part of the paper that I actually really like, and it's much longer than usually in papers like this. We go through all the real world issues that are different from the model. Mm-hmm. Right? We start out by saying, "Here's a beautiful model. Here's a beautiful theory." And here's a whole section that says, "Okay, this issue and that issue and this and this." And this is what we ended up doing differently because of real world considerations. So there is, it's not like you just take that model literally, you know, you just put it into code, the formula, and you're done. It was you know, months and months of work to go through all these issues one by one and say, how do we adapt this brilliant idea and brilliant framework to this particular real world issue?
I'm going to step back maybe and actually also talk a little bit about how reserve prices work in general, just so that the viewers and listeners can map the two together. So reserve price is a price at which you reserve the right not to sell the item that you're putting out. And as Michael sort of mentioned, we should have some sort of a realistic price, because obviously if two customers show up and we've taken $3 to produce something and they both bid like $1 and $2, we don't want to give it out, right? Like, yep, we want to at least recover the cost back. But you can do more. Yes. One of the things that you can do more is actually signal back into the market a little bit around what the true valuation that, or parting valuation that you have for that asset. Particularly, this is useful in a context where, let's say, we have private consumption value for the good, right? Like, a key example could be, like, let's say you're a marketplace and you can choose to show either your own product in a slot, or you can actually choose to show some other product in the slot. These are examples where reserve price tends to work really well, right? Yep. Like, if you derive $2.
I know the value to me.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, you have your private value.
Then I have an exact BATNA.
You have the exact BATNA, best alternative to negotiated agreements. Yeah.
Right.
So this is precisely what, you know, like the reserve price enables, which is you could say, like, okay, if I'm willing to sell if the price is more than this, if not, great, I'm going to go take it and consume it in my end. And so if I have a marketplace that has, you know, the ability to show external ads and my own product, if I know I can have some conversion for my product, I would actually put my valuation as the reserve price. So that way, the moment I'm not displaced, which is I am not the right person for that ad, like, I can actually then come back and consume it. And this actually happens to be good for the society as well, right? Like, because at that point in time, you're using that slot or like whatever the commodity that is in scarcity to the best extent possible.
Yep. So that's so basically what you said is exactly right, in that if you do have some value for the good, you should for sure set the reserve price at least at that level.
Yes.
And where the wedge between efficiency and revenue comes into the picture, that from the point of view of your own revenue, you can do even better by raising it even slightly more than that. So in fact, you start out by computing BATNA, and then you can get a bit more by, you know, you have to be very disciplined about it. Like, you need to be careful, but you can in fact get a bit more. But at the very least, you know, if you do have some value for the slot, you should absolutely set that as a reserve price. Actually, a good example of this is for a search engine, you know, that value may be small, because in practice, if they don't show the ad, they will show nothing there. But for newer platforms like, you know, Amazon or other retailers, ads tend to displace organic results. And organic results, if you show just some catalog item, there is some expected value that they will convert, generate commissions. So at the very least, the reserve price for the slot has to be the expected revenue from this organic.
And
organic,
you can also reserve, have private Amazon brands.
And where same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. This
and
is
that
one of the areas.
Economic change and other incentives.
Yep.
I want to go back to something you said, which we goes back to what we talked about before the session, which is this gap between the, you know, the theory and the reality.
Yep.
And I think one of the things that inspired us to do the podcast was this notion of the emerging tech economist and the full-fledged role of economics.
Yep.
And you captured a whole bunch of interesting things, how there's like a direct line between spectrum auctions, probably the predecessor sort of large-scale high-value auction, to internet auctions, and now to this sort of explosion of interesting pricing, inventory, capital allocation, all kinds of interesting allocation. But all in that is that all operates in the hypothesis that we can translate these economic models to reality. And it sounds like you've ended up with a case study, an existence proof of how that's done, and like granular understanding of what that distance really is.
So I think case study is a good way to characterize it, in part because I think, you know, I've done it in a few different applications, and every time, you know, there are some principles that are kind of the same, but there are also some differences. That's why you know, each case is different. And so my kind of rule of thumb, I think it's, you know, there is a science part where, you know, you prove a mathematical theorem, it's a mathematical theorem, right? That's sort of, you know, as long as the proof is correct, it's true. But then there is more of an art part where how does that mathematical theorem connect to this particular real world situation? And kind of my rules of thumb are, first, you really need to understand the situation. You should sort of forget about this beautiful model that you've written down and really try to understand, you know, talk to the bidders, talk to the sellers, talk to the engineers who actually put this in practice, learn all the edge cases and quirks and all the issues. And then comes this part that's very hard to make algorithmic, where there is a judgment call. We're like, okay, now that I know all of this words and quirks and bells and whistles, which of them can I ignore? Because if you try to build a model that incorporates everything, it's going to be unmanageable. It's going to be, so you're really not going to get any traction. So you really need to try to say, okay, what are the first order things? And then you can iterate, right? So you build a model with those first order things. You see what the results are, and then you either put it in practice, or maybe you will talk to product managers or engineers, and they will say, oh, like this thing you overlooked, that's totally first order. Let me tell you about this particular story. And then you may need to go back, or maybe you will only use this particular beautiful model just for a subset of the market that you're. That you're developing.
Well, super. So you almost need one part economics, one part anthropology. In situ observation. That's got to be somebody. That's a different set of people that have both of those skills in the same.
I think anthropology is exactly the word I would use. And in fact, I teach a PhD class on market design at Stanford, and the main assignment for the class is to write a project proposal. Mm-hmm. And what I tell the students is, I said, look, there are two ways to do it. One is try to write a model of some interesting market that you're thinking about. And the second one, and I literally use that word, you should write an almost anthropological study of a particular marketplace where you go and like you talk to people and you learn what the issues are. And then, with the eye towards... then turning it into model. And in fact, I just thought about this now, but it's, I think it's a good example. There is a book on auctions by Cassidy that is very, very old, and it is an anthropological study. It predates Vickery. It predates basically all of the auction theory, where he just kind of went around and wrote down all the interesting auctions he wrote about, like some auctions in the Roman Empire and all kinds of different, he tried to systematize it, but it was not what we would call auction theory right now. But I think what makes this whole area of market design so interesting is that you really need to go and understand.
It's a field survey.
Not necessarily a survey. Like, you don't have to write a survey, but at least in your head, you have to have a pretty decent idea of what... those things look like. Of course, eventually you do need to put it into formulas, into code, into a mathematical model.
I want to actually also kind of like probe your thoughts around congestion pricing. You were talking about it.
Absolutely.
Like with the Tesla.
I think that's a topic that everybody can relate to. With the end of COVID, we're all back on the freeway today.
I mean, in fact, that's how I started working on it. It was literally, I was being stuck on the highway. And I'm like, this is crazy. Like, this is like economists have been talking about this for generations, and somehow we have all the technology needed.
And you either pay for toll or you pay with time.
But in most roads you can't actually. I mean, there are now some roads where you can pay for toll, but most roads you can't. And the other concern that I had was, kind of at the time, so I started thinking about this about 10 years ago, kind of more leisurely and like less actively. And back then, the self-driving cars were just getting started, right? So this is where Google self-driving cars, they started.
Waymo.
I think it was even before Waymo. It was still Google X. And I was actually talking to Michael Schwartz about this, and we had this realization. It's like, wait a minute. So self-driving car for an individual person is wonderful, because now you can sleep in the car, you can read in the car, you can do work. So that's wonderful. So that sounds like a wonderful contribution. But then if everyone thinks this way, then now instead of trying to beat traffic, instead of trying to live closer to where you work, you say, oh, I'm going to live 2 hours away from my work, and I'll just sleep in the car. If I need to sleep for 4 hours in the car, that's fine. I'll sleep. And so the level of traffic congestion will go up. And we started thinking about what's the, you know, is there any way to fix this? And so then, you know, the natural question is congestion. The natural answer is congestion pricing. But congestion pricing has the following fundamental issue, which you can see in practice every time it tries to get implemented, and that is people hate it. And the reason why people hate it, it's actually at first you're like, oh, maybe they don't understand how wonderful it's going to be. But the truth is, for congestion pricing to be effective, the level of prices has to be comparable in order to the disutility they're suffering right now from congestion. So for the commuters, they're individually not better off. They're kind of on average, they're kind of as well off as they were in traffic. Now, of course, society as a whole is better off because all this time that was wasted in traffic is turned into money, and the money can be used for good purposes. But that's very hard to explain. Well, first of all, you know, you need to trust the government to do that. You need to make sure that the money actually gets deployed in ways that people benefit from. And our second insight, and that's when we started writing the papers, was that what can really move the needle is carpooling. And the reason, so that for, like, normally people don't think about congestion and carpooling as related at all. And by the way, by carpooling, we mean just kind of putting more people in cars, broadly understood. Like, we don't mean public transportation. We just mean you still have personal cars or minivans, but you put more people. Because if you think about kind of again, the fundamental economic efficiency, when you're stuck on the highway, if you look around, most of the cars have just one person in the car, right? And the fact that they're all stuck at the same time on the same stretch of the highway means that there are probably lots of potential carpool matches because they're going from roughly the same place to roughly the same place at roughly the same time. The problem is they don't have an incentive to carpool right now because if I carpool with you, now we're both stuck in traffic.
Right.
And so there is no benefit. What's magical about congestion pricing jointly with carpooling is that if you and I carpool and pay the toll instead of paying that amount of time in our just wasted time, we can split the toll.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so if we carpool and waste time in traffic, we both pay. You know, we total we pay double the cost. But if we carpool, I only pay have to pay half.
Right.
If I carpool with four other people, I only have to pay one. Oops, sorry, I only have to pay 1/5 of the amount. So that gives so that combination gives people a strong incentive to start carpooling, and it's not that hard. Especially with self-driving cars, it's going to be even easier. And so what also happens once people start carpooling, the effective capacity of the roads increases, right? So if every car, even without changing the cars, if every car had four passengers instead of one, four people, you just increase the throughput of the road by a factor of four with no technological intervention, right? So the only change is you now have tolls. And so in this work, we're analyzing these joint systems, how would you design a system and what would the equilibrium look like? If you encourage carpooling, make it very convenient, make it much less costly, and at the same time, impose meaningful tolls, because individually these two tools don't work, but together they can really relieve congestion.
Yeah, a lot of people get this, supply side of it wrong, because they might think, oh, if you build a broader highway, that'll be great. But then the moment you build a broader highway, you're encouraging more people to then drive. That actually ends up bringing even more congestion. So what you're saying is a little bit of a twist where you have a two-part mechanism. Yes. One is you create congestion pricing to make sure that the high-value real estate is actually monetized, right?
Yep.
And then the other part, you also give people an outlet where they can leverage their collective actions in some form and reduce that toll on themselves.
I guess hidden there is the notion, though, that you actually have to price that congestion toll at a material level.
Absolutely.
And that material level may or may not be socially acceptable to...
So our thesis, this is where, this is the model where we'll see how well it matches to reality, is that if all people drive individually, it's very hard to make it sort of socially acceptable because it's a high number. It has to be a high number. But once you build in this possibility of convenient carpooling. So let's say we have 10-person minivans that go without traffic. So basically think about it. So right now we're in Milpitas, and if I want to drive to San Francisco at 5:30 p.m., that's probably a complete nightmare. So if I tell you, you can live in the current world where you drive by yourself and you're stuck in traffic for an hour and a half, or you drive with nine other people. You know, it's door to door, so it's like, it's not like you have to make your commute more complicated. But there's no traffic, right? You just go at, you know, 70 miles per hour. You just have nine other co-passengers. You know, I think a substantial number of people will say, oh, like the second thing is actually great.
So how much do you think this effect of having automatic cars is going to change this equilibrium? Because the part of the equation there is, I've not bought a car. You know, that's something that I have to pay the EMI no matter what. Or like I'm at least, you know, even if I didn't borrow and I put the capital in, it's one-time investment.
Mm-hmm.
Now with an auto taxi, right, like the thing that can drive by itself, it would change this door-to-door equation a little bit.
Yep.
And it'll make it less of a fixed cost, more of a variable cost for individual commuters. So how much does that sort of affect the equilibrium?
I think it's going to help a lot. I think for a couple of reasons. One is it makes forming these multi-person carpools much easier.
Right.
Because there is no, like, you know, right now you can still do it. So with one person, it's easier. Like if you say, okay, well, it's going to be five people carpool. Now it becomes really painful. If you're the driver, you have to go pick all these five people up, then drop them off. So like the coordination becomes trickier. Whereas if it's a self-driving car, just does everything. Like, you know, you just get a ping that it's approaching. You go, you get into it with four other people, and you know, and that's that. The other thing, which is at first not obvious, but then you realize it's very important, is you have this flexibility where you erase the line between solo and public transportation. So for example, you can drive to work on your own. Suppose you go to work at some really odd hour or you need to run some weird errand. You can pay a little bit more and drive solo, but then on the way back you can carpool, which right now is just completely infeasible, right? Because if you drive solo to work, you have to drive solo back. It's just like, you know, because you took your own car.
Or you have to wait for the coordination challenge of a big bus to show up or train to show up.
But even with that, you have to match your morning commute to your evening commute, right? It has to be the same mode of transportation. And now you get this extra flexibility where you can drive solo on the way to work and with other people on the way back. So it's really going to expand the possibility frontier quite dramatically.
So if I play all that back, there's going to be this magical moment because we need the sort of the technology to come together with the political willpower, with the social force, with enough pain from the steady state that all of this can actually flip into being.
So I've thought about this actually. How do you go from papers to actually seeing it in practice? And the good news is that the world is big.
Right.
So there are lots of congested cities in the world.
Right.
And it's not like one of them will just magically flip from the current congestion to like everything being right. I think it's going to be step by step where London already has congestion pricing.
Right.
It's imperfect. It has lots of issues, but, you know, they have it. Singapore has congestion pricing. So once one city makes a step forward, then other cities will say, oh, we're going to replicate that and then do it even better. Same thing as with advertising auctions, right? Like the first one was not perfect.
Right.
And then someone else said, oh, we're going to take that and then we're going to change these things. And then the original company went back and copied. So I don't think it's going to be like,
these things can ladder.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be like one magical moment. I think it's going to be kind of step by step. I think maybe three, four, five steps. It's going to take, 10, 20, 30 years. But I think I think it's feasible. I think with the current technology, it's doable. And, now I say current technology, I used to, when I talked about those papers before, I would always put it in future tense.
Right.
But, you know, in this June, Waymo finally announced that anyone can go and take a Waymo in San Francisco. You don't need to be on the wait list. You don't like it. So, so I think now it's real. Like, it's no longer science fiction. It's real. Now it's just a matter of scaling it, and which, of course, there is a lot of work to do that, but it's all sort of, I think it went from science fiction to an engineering problem.
Seemingly overnight. It's truly amazing.
I don't know overnight.
In terms of the realization, the tipping point of Waymo in San Francisco I think 6 months ago, people were vandalizing cars and squawking about it. And now it's just, just shock and awe.
You know, there is a phrase I think that would apply to this perfectly. Like, it's an overnight success,
10 years
in the
making. Right.
And this is almost literally
literally true in this case.
It's literally true in this case, yes.
So now what in your Stanford role, what do you see the trajectory of economic students? What's the changing nature of the people you see coming through your programs and where are people turning their attentions to?
So that's an interesting question. So I teach in two different programs. I teach in the MBA program and I teach in the PhD program. And I think in the MBA program, the makeup of students is still fairly similar, mm-hmm. right? These are ambitious young people who want to do cool new things. And, you know, our MBA program kind of very deliberately tries to get people with all kinds of different backgrounds, mm-hmm. right? We don't want just a class full of iBankers and consultants, even though we have quite a few of them. Right. But we want, you know, some people from manufacturing, mm-hmm. some people from the military, some people from, you know, sports, some people mm-hmm. from entertainment. So it's really, because I think the production function is that the students get an amazing network of people from all walks of life and all the geographical regions and all the industries so that they can benefit from that going forward. I think on the output side, where they do get jobs, I do think now a lot more students end up at exciting tech companies. I think it used. I think finance used to be a bigger outlet for our MBA students. You know, management consulting also, and I think now a lot more students, on a relative basis, go into all kinds of both established tech companies and startups. A lot of them create their own companies. In fact, I think in the rankings a few years ago, Stanford was not penalized, but I think it was a little bit lower than...
They put main, entrepreneurs and job lists in the same bucket.
That's exactly right. Other, because like, they look like employed 3 months after graduation. Right. We were like something like, I don't remember the exact number, like 85%.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And you're like, oh, this is terrible. Like, right. No, those 15%, right. they're all starting
their
own companies.
Space.
Yeah, yeah. So that's that. On the PhD students, I think it's actually very similar to what it was 10, 20 mm-hmm. years ago. We have a lot of students with very strong technical backgrounds, with deep interest in economics, and then some of them end up doing kind of more theoretical work. Some of them end up doing empirical work where they analyze existing markets, you know, and existing institutions. And then a third group is somewhere in the middle where they do more like market design type things where it's still mostly theory driven, but very much with an eye to practical problems.
Yeah, my daughter's an econ sophomore at Brown.
Okay.
And John Friedman at Brown just wrote this seminal paper on the standardized testing for college admission.
Okay.
So I feel between standardized testing and traffic, you know, economists are dealing with like the two most important issues in the modern world, right? Which college can get my kid into, and how do I get to and from work?
I think economics is a very exciting field. I mean, it's very difficult. And I think it's difficult precisely for the reasons we discussed, where, you know, you can write a mathematical model of testing and traffic and everything and be happy with your theorems, but then the challenging part is, did you capture the first order things? Did you actually say something useful about the real world? And, you know, unlike, you know, in physics or, you know, engineering, the quality of approximation is by necessity much coarser.
Right.
It's more like, you know, you're not going to get such a close approximation, and you know it in advance,
right.
And yet you're trying to get something that's both sound and actually provides something useful, despite the fact that you kind of know that the model is much more of a caricature of the world.
I feel like for us, there's a burst of delight every time something happens in the real world that matches the model.
Yes.
You see, I knew it was going to happen, and that's gratification.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Just a super session. I think everyone's going to find it really interesting. We look forward to, I guess, papers coming out on congestion pricing and other interesting topics.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for inviting me. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you enjoyed it, like, share, and subscribe. And we're always looking forward to hearing your feedback. And be on the lookout for the next episode of Silicon Economics.